Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. This is a really extraordinary day, January 5th, 2020. I think that some of us might have thought that things would have calmed down by now, but no. So here we are, really at the brink. You have the Georgia runoffs today that will determine the control of the United States Senate while the president is still, frankly, seems to be escalating his campaign to overturn the election. Of course, tomorrow, Congress meets, and even though the Constitution does not give it any power to overturn the vote of the Electoral College, its role is strictly ministerial. You have millions of Americans and many members of Congress who are apparently under the impression that somehow they can vote to overturn this election or to refuse to count the election. I mean, people ought to go and read the Constitution, the Article 12, which basically just says that the role of vice president is simply a glorified letter opener. He opens the envelopes of the legal certifications and the Congress counts them. So that's going to happen tomorrow. It appears that at least a dozen, or more than a dozen, Republican senators will vote to disenfranchise millions of voters, more than 100 members of the House of Representatives, maybe as many as 140 or more, who knows, will also cast that vote. In the end, I don't want to have a spoiler alert here, but I understand that this will fail. Whatever happens will fail, and this will go ahead, except the president's sense of desperation seems to be rising. And I think that this is something that we need to pay attention to. The president went to Georgia last night, and where obviously, you know, Senator Loeffler and Perdue are groveling, saying that they will support him, you know, no matter what. It's really become our own Tim Miller at the Bulwark has a great piece about the MAGA nihilism. They don't stand for anything other than loyalty to Trump. But Trump didn't go down there, you know, so much to help them as to continue his grievance campaign. And we could play a lot of different sound bites, but I want to play this one because it's really extraordinary that the president seems to be under the impression that Vice President Pence somehow has the power to nullify this election. This is what he said last night.
And I hope Mike Pence comes through for us, I have to tell you. I hope that our great vice president comes through for us. He's a great guy. Of course, if he doesn't come through, I won't like him quite as much. Now, Mike is a great guy. He's a wonderful man and a smart man and a man that I like a lot. But he's going to have a lot to say about it. And you know one thing with him, you're going to get straight shots. He's going to call it straight.
Now, this is from the New York Times this morning, which writes about the gut-wrenching choice that Mike Pence has to make. There should be nothing gut-wrenching about doing your constitutional duty. But they report some of Trump's advisors have helped fuel the idea that Pence could affect the outcome of the election. In an interview with Jeanine Pirro on Fox News, Peter Navarro, a White House trade advisor, claimed inaccurately that Pence could unilaterally grant a demand by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and 11 other Republican senators for an emergency 10-day audit of the election returns in the states that Trump allies are disputing. Apparently, on Saturday morning, Trump called Pence and expressed surprise that the Justice Department had weighed in against a completely bogus lawsuit filed by Trump supporters, including House members, seeking to expand Pence's powers in the process. The suit was dismissed on Friday by a federal judge in Texas, whom Mr. Trump had appointed. One person close to Pence described Wednesday's duties as gut-wrenching. I mean, really, you're a glorified letter opener. Well, we have a special guest to talk about all of this today. Eric Edelman comes back on the podcast. Eric Edelman is a former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, U.S. Ambassador to Turkey and to Finland, and played a key role in one of the developments that I think might turn out to be decisive, that extraordinary letter by all of the living former secretaries of defense. Forcefully making the case the military has no role in the peaceful transfer of power. Ambassador Edelman, thank you for coming back.
Thank you, Charlie. It's great to be with you this morning.
Well, let's talk about this right before we started, you and I, right before we started the podcast, you and I were chatting briefly, and I said that I just had a sense that the momentum was shifting, has shifted since Saturday, that that there was seemed like there was a rush among Republicans to cast the easy vote, to not count the Electoral College votes, but that there's been a real pushback. And in the last 24 hours, we've seen not just Senator Tom Cotton, but also Senator Mike Lee, Senators Cramer and Hoeven, among others, saying, no, we're supporters of Trump, but we are not going to vote to overturn this election. So do you get the same sense? I just feel that there's more of a willingness to say, okay, this is a mistake. We can't do this. We are not going to besmirch ourselves in this particular way. We're not going to undermine the Constitution. Do you think the momentum has shifted?
I do think that. I do think that, and I certainly hope that that's the case. Of course, you know, the proof will be in the pudding on tomorrow when they have to, you know, go through this constitutional process. I do hope that the letter from the secretaries, you know, has had a sobering effect. I'm sure that that's what most of the secretaries had in mind when we agreed that timing should be, you know, publication in print in the Post on Monday and posting on their website Sunday night. As it turned out, it coincided with the release of the tape of the president's unbelievable phone call with Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State of Georgia, which I think heightened, you know, sort of the valence of the concern the secretaries were expressing about the potential that the president might use the military in some kind of extra constitutional way to either overturn the election or somehow extend his term in office beyond what the Constitution and statute allows. You were quoting Navarro's comments to that effect. I think all of this had, you know, an impact. But I think the combination of his own words to Brad Raffensperger, indicating he's willing to do anything to stay in office, you know, made their concerns, you know, more clear. And then there was also this extraordinary 21-page memo by the head of the Republican conference, Liz Cheney, outlining, you know, why all of this that you were talking about earlier, these efforts to invoke the election of 1876 and the commission that resolved that and all these other arguments just hold no water and are totally bogus. So I think, you know, the combination of all these things, I hope, is beginning to, you know, turn the tide a bit.
I think those three things are the most important. I do think that you line them up: the letter from the Secretaries of Defense, Liz Cheney's memo, and the release of the phone call. I think gave people more pause. Liz Cheney, I'm glad you mentioned Liz Cheney's memo, because it is a remarkable document that would have not been controversial in conservative circles until 5 minutes ago, laying out the dangers of the precedent of having Congress override the states, in effect, abolishing elections as we know it, and allowing the majority of whatever political party holds Congress to be able to somehow veto all of that. And she's pointing out this is just completely, there's nothing conservative about this. There is no conservative tradition that is upheld by the act of not counting the votes. It's a very, very important document. And I imagine that some of the Republicans that rush to sign on to all of this are, if in fact they read it, which is questionable, of course, they'd be embarrassed. I mean, they might be ashamed to realize, you know, how unconstitutional, how extra constitutional this is, and what a horrible precedent it sets for the relationship between the federal government and the dominating political party in Washington and state governments. I mean, it really did shame them.
I think so. And I think Senator Cotton, who then came out subsequently with a statement,
made that point.
In some ways echoed some of the themes. I mean, his statement was much shorter, of course, but it echoed, you know, essentially the theme that it's not up to the Congress to overturn an election.
No, that's exactly right. So let's talk about this letter, because I agree with you also that you listen to the phone call and you listen to the president talking right now. And frankly, it is hard to come away without believing that this man will do anything to retain office. I think he said last night in Georgia, they're not taking the White House away from us. What does that actually mean? because I don't think he's going to give up on January 6th. So there are, you know, certain people out there, the Hugh Hewitts of the world, that say, oh, it's, you know, you guys are catastrophizing. It's no big deal. This is Trump derangement syndrome. But if you listen to that phone call and you listen to him, you have a president who is prepared to do anything, as you mentioned. So talk to me a little bit about how this letter came about. You have been identified as one of the key players in putting this together. Every living ex-Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, Mark Esper, Donald Rumsfeld, James Mattis, William Cohen, every single one of them signed on to this letter. So how did it come about? Ambassador, give me some sense of how something like this happens.
Well, my role, I want to make clear, I mean, this is their statement, and my role really was a kind of role I played through my 30 years in government, which was to be a staff, you know, factotum for these folks. I mean, I have either worked for or with, in different guises, all 10 of them. So I guess I was in a position to be able to reach out to them either directly or indirectly to get them to agree on a statement. I mean, I don't think, Charlie, I could get these 10 men to agree on what time of day it is today.
Exactly.
When it came to getting them to agree that we need to preserve the institutions, the norms, and the processes of our democratic republic, I was able to do it over New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, basically within 24 hours.
Really? Okay, so let's go back to the beginning, though. I really want to get some sense of how something like this happens. So whose idea was it? Who was alarmed enough to say, we need to do this?
Yeah, well, I talk periodically to Vice President Cheney, because I worked for him twice, once when he was Secretary of Defense as a Assistant Deputy Undersecretary in the Pentagon, and once as his Deputy National Security Advisor when he was Vice President. And of course, I was Undersecretary for the second term of Bush 43, and so worked with him closely then as well. And I would say I talked to him maybe once a quarter, something like that. And during the course of the summer, he knows I'm, you know, a Never Trumper, that I signed all four of the Never Trump letters back in 2016. And I've shared my reservations about Trump with him. I told him as a courtesy this summer that I was going to be part of the group of former Republican national security officials who endorsed Joe Biden for president, and he certainly didn't discourage me from doing that. Among others, Sean O'Keefe, who was his controller of the Pentagon and later Secretary of the Navy in Bush 41, was one of my colleagues in organizing that effort. During the course of the fall have shared my increasing misgivings about where Trump was about leaving government, et cetera. When the David Ignatius column came out in the Post, and you're going to have to forgive me if I don't get the chronology of all this right.
Because
in the rush of the Trump era, he's creating more news than we can consume. And sometimes it's tough to keep it all straight. But I think it was last Monday, David Ignatius had a column in the Washington Post in which he talked about concerns in the Pentagon about
December 26th, the day after Christmas, until Biden's win is certified, the U.S. remains vulnerable.
Right. And it talked about
alarming.
It was very alarming. It talked about concerns in the Pentagon about a potential misuse of the military by Trump. I served in Moscow as a diplomat, and I used to read Izvestia and Pravda very carefully to try and discern what was going on in the Pentagon. And it's a habit I've never lost. So I read the New York Times and the Washington Post the same way. And although I haven't talked to David and don't know exactly, you know, where he got that from, it struck me that this clearly was reflecting General Milley's concerns. And it resonated with things I had heard from former colleagues in the Pentagon. You know, as a former undersecretary, I hear from time to time from people who are still in the building. And it certainly resonated with some conversations I'd had with former Secretary Esper since he left government.
Okay, let me just read the opening of this, since we're at the beginning here. This is December 26th. David Ignatius in the Washington Post starts off by saying, not to be alarmist, but we should recognize the United States will be in the danger zone until the formal certification of Joe Biden's election victory on January 6th, because potential domestic and foreign turmoil could give President Trump an excuse to cling to power. This threat, while unlikely to materialize, is concerning senior officials, including Republicans who have supported Trump in the past, but believe he is now threatening to overstep the constitutional limits on his power. They described a multifaceted campaign by diehard Trump supporters to use disruptions at home and perhaps threats abroad to advance his interests. Hmm. Okay, so you read this, you and others read this, and...
It set off alarm bells for me, and... I consulted with my colleague at Johns Hopkins, Sice, Elliot Cohen, who is a former student of Samuel Huntington's, and after Sam's passing a couple of years ago, is probably, if not the senior academic in the United States on civilian-military relations, certainly one of them. Elliot, shared my concern, and then I spoke to Vice President Cheney and expressed my concerns, and I think he shared them, and so I had been brainstorming with Elliot about the idea of perhaps getting a group of former secretaries of defense to provide a letter of some kind, either a letter or op-ed. I had in mind actually an op-ed I don't agree with, which is the one that back, I think, in 2007 in the Wall Street Journal that George Shultz and another one of my former bosses and Henry Kissinger, Bill Perry and Sam Nunn did about nuclear weapons, which has had a long and lasting impact. And I was hoping that we could get something that might have that kind of impact. Mm-hmm. Honestly, initially, I didn't really even think that we would be able to get all 10, living former SecDefs on board. We went to Cheney, said, look, draft something up and let me see what it looks like. And I took a crack at it and gave it to Elliot, who, as you would expect, because of his writings in The Atlantic, is a terrific stylist, made it much better, shortened it up, made it more kind of, op-ed-like. Cheney gave us some feedback on it, which we took into account to try and, make it something that others would sign on to. And then I started reaching out both directly and indirectly to the former secretaries, and they all really, as I said, within a very short period of time, signed up. I mean, I think by Wednesday afternoon, the 31st, I think I had seven. By early evening, I had eight, and so I was waiting on the last two. I went to my colleagues at the Post. And said, would you be interested in this? I'm hoping we can get all 10. And they said, we're very interested and agreed. We agreed on the timing and getting it ready and copy edited and whatnot. And by noon on New Year's Day, we had all 10 signed up.
Wow. Wow. So this is very forcefully written. I want to read one paragraph. As senior Defense Department leaders have noted, there is no role for the U.S. military in determining the outcome of a U.S. election. Efforts to involve the U.S. armed forces in resolving election disputes would take us into dangerous, unlawful, and unconstitutional territory. Civilian and military officials who direct or carry out such measures would be accountable, including potentially facing criminal penalties for the grave consequences of their action on our republic. Who was that aimed to? This reads like a shot across the bow, but who was your audience there?
So I think this was meant to be what we say, calling the Department of Defense supporting fire for Chairman Milley, for General McConville, the Chief of Staff of the Army, Secretary of the Army, Brian McCarthy, all of whom have made statements using the language we quoted. And I have great confidence in all of them and certainly all the senior officers that they would not follow an illegal order and that they believe what they said, that the military has no role in settling these political disputes in a democratic republic with our constitution. And I'm quite confident that if they were given such an order, they would resign. I mean, they would protest, they would push back, and then they would resign. But, you know, eventually you get, you know, further down the chain. And we wanted, I think, to make clear that, you know, if you're a colonel someplace and you get this, you know, order to go seize voting machines or something, which when you think about in the context of the president's phone call to Brad Raffensperger about, you know, excessively talking about the Fulton County voting machines and the parts being replaced and all of this other conspiratorial nonsense from QAnon and 4chan and all the rest of it, you know, that you would have pause if you were an officer about going out and executing that order, because we do have laws in the United States against the military interfering with elections or with the election officials carrying out their official duties.
Well, and we also know that, you know, former General Flynn, the National Security Advisor, had sat in the Oval Office discussing the possibility of declaring martial law with the president. So the clear message here is that the military would not participate in any sort of a coup, any sort of declaration of martial law, rerunning elections or anything like that. I guess the obvious question is, why did you think that need to be said? Shouldn't that be just so clearly obvious they wouldn't do it? So what was the motive for these guys to inject themselves at this time into something this radioactive? I mean, wouldn't the easiest thing for them to be say, this is obvious, of course they're not going to do it. No, nobody thinks this will happen.
You know, I mean, I don't want to speak for them because this is really their statement, but I do note that, you know, Secretary Cohen was on television yesterday. You and I were just talking about
it. Fantastic.
And he basically, I think, expressed what I believe they all think, which is that this president is unpredictable and mercurial enough that he might take steps that would either try to overturn the election using the military or an international incident of some kind to declare a national emergency or to extend his stay in office. I mean, again, you quoted Peter Navarro is saying maybe we could postpone the inauguration. I mean, these are all steps that take us outside the Constitution, outside statute law. And I think, you know, Secretary Hagel was quoted in the Washington Post on Monday morning as saying when he first looked at the letter, he thought maybe this is just a bit of an overreaction. And he decided, no, we really should issue this. And I think the regret factor here is, you know, would you feel worse not saying something and then having the president do this? Or would you feel worse that you said something and maybe it helped keep him or others from carrying out such acts?
Well, you probably saw the tweet from David Frum that came out yesterday, I think. January 4th. Yeah. The letter from the 10 former SecDefs warning against Trump using the military to hold on power causes me to wonder, Frum wrote, has Trump been making calls to U.S. generals like he made to Georgia Secretary of State, demanding, threatening that they help him overturn the 2020 election?
I don't know the answer to that. I cannot tell you whether he's made calls to that effect. I can tell you that and I was just speaking to a former senior Trump administration official this morning that, you know, he's been talking to people. There are people who are prepared to resign and, you know, are concerned that the president might do something. And I think the phone call that was released on Sunday has only heightened everybody's concern.
So during Watergate, famously, you correct me if I'm wrong on my facts here, the Secretary of Defense was James Schlesinger, and they were so concerned about what Richard Nixon might do in his final days that he gave orders to he gave orders not to follow the president's any orders that came from the president. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's that. You know, it is alleged that Secretary Schlesinger did, tell the National Military Command Center not to follow through on any presidential order that either involved major movements of troops or use of nuclear weapons.
Wow. I mean, are we at that point yet?
Well, we don't have a Secretary of Defense. We have an acting Secretary of Defense. And, you know, you and I talked a couple of weeks ago about this after Secretary Esper was fired. You know, I think that's one of the concerns that the secretaries had as well, you know, was partly to, you know, asked who the audience was. I think partly it's Secretary Miller and the civilians around him.
To make sure that you wonder what the phone calls to him are like. Yeah. So when I read David's tweet, I was thinking, I don't know that he would call the generals. He calls them the my generals, but I could certainly imagine that that he might call and have conversations with some of his loyalists who are in key positions in the Department of Defense. I mean, people need to understand that there are people there who in a normal world would never be in the jobs they are in, are there right now. And Trump undoubtedly thinks that he can call on their loyalty.
Well, absolutely. We know that there's been at least, one communication between Trump and Miller, and that has to do with the Nimitz and, countermanding the orders that Miller had previously given to pull the Nimitz out of the Persian Gulf. I mean, there is, I think, genuine and legitimate concern about Iran in the next few days. I mean, we had January 3rd, the anniversary of the strike against Soleimani and Mohandas in Baghdad that might have been the occasion for some kind of attempt by the Iranians to wreak revenge on the U.S. I think on the 7th, it's the 40th day, if I'm not mistaken, of since Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was killed, the head of the Iranian nuclear program. So there's some concern there might be an attempt to avenge his death with some kind of action on the 7th. And that's always a concern that you might have a genuine crisis here of some kind that's playing out against this backdrop that we've been talking about. But whether there have been other communications with Miller, et cetera, I don't know. But the thing that was concerning in the Ignatius piece was the recounting that they are, as he put it, trying to understand how to move the levers inside the department to get things done. And one of the levers you worry about them using is their ability to move troops around domestically and perhaps try and either precipitate or use the Insurrection Act somehow to carry out some of these crazier plans that you were referring to earlier that Mike Flynn and others have been brooding about.
In retrospect, and tell me whether you agree with this, the incident Lafayette Square where the president used force to clear out demonstrators so he could have a photo op at St. John's Church, that seemed to be kind of a turning point, or at least it was really definitely a wake up call to the members of the military. General Milley obviously was deeply chagrined about his role and the way that he was used in all of that. A lot of his comments seemed to be in direct response to Trump's, his co-op, the fact that he was co-opted by Trump for that to make it look like somehow that the military was supporting Trump's effort. Do you agree with that? That looms large in the imagination or the concerns of people in the military right now?
I think there's no question about it. I mean, both Secretary Milley and General Milley and Secretary Esper did walk back their participation in the Lafayette Square event. My sense is both of them didn't quite understand what it was that they were doing when they went off on that walkabout with President Trump. I'm pretty sure neither one of them knew he was, going to be going over to St. John's Church and, wave a Bible in the air for a photo op. So I think both of them have, been careful since then to make it clear that the military has no role in politics. Now, this for Esper became, one of the breaking points. I mean, and I suspect what's going to come out is that, people had been deriding, Secretary Esper as Secretary Yesper because publicly he tried up until that point to, color within the lines, as it were, in the Trump administration, which I think he had to do to survive. But my sense is that, once we get the full story, I think people will realize for about 18 months, he was resisting a lot of stuff inside the administration, which led to a buildup of Trump's concerns about Esper. And the irony is he got fired in the end of the day, not for being, Mark Yesper, but not for being Mark Yesper.
Well, that was among the names, of course, that was raised the eyebrows. Mark Esper and James Mattis, both Trump appointees as Secretary of Defense. So the list of the 10, Ashton Carter, Dick Cheney, William Cohen, Mark Esper, Robert Gates, Chuck Hagel, Mattis, Leon Panetta, William Perry, and Donald Rumsfeld all signed this. Look, you put that group together, and there's a lot of experience, and they must have a lot of contacts still within the Department of Defense. So this goes back to the question of what is your sense that they were hearing from people from within the Department of Defense that would make them take a step as signing this letter?
You know, I think I can't speak to what each of them was hearing, but I think what you see is what we discussed earlier, the sense they had about the president, his character. You know, we've talked about Lafayette Square. That obviously was a wake-up call. By the way, there was a letter, I was a signatory, I think it was 86, former senior defense officials in the Post back in June, had a letter saying not appropriate to use the military for these purposes. We need to keep the military out of politics. I think there have been other things that have happened, you know, since Secretary Esper was fired and this group of political appointees was, you know, inserted into the Department of Defense. Some of those things, you know, you can put a positive, you know, benign construction on. So, for instance, the resubordination of the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict to become a direct report to the secretary rather than reporting through my old position as undersecretary. There's been language, you know, in the NDAA going back to 2017. That's the National Defense Authorization Act Congress passes each year.
They just passed over Trump's veto, his first veto override, overwhelmingly.
Correct. The 2017 law had, you know, recommendation to do something along these lines to provide better civilian oversight of special operations train and equip missions. There's a question about separating the dual-hatted structure we have for cyber defense with CyberCom, the Cyber Defense Command, and the NSA, the National Security Agency, being the head being dual-hatted as both. And there are arguments pro and con for you know, splitting CyberCom from NSA. Mm-hmm. But the fact that this was all being done sort of in the last 60 days of the Trump administration, with an administration that was desperately, contesting the election and fighting to stay on. And the idea that, for instance, some of these political loyalists would be installed in positions, civilians in positions like the director of the NSA, which has traditionally been, not always, but I think traditionally been a military billet. I think it's the whole picture,
yeah.
Charlie, I think, that, you know, created this unsettling feeling that he might do some of these really outlandish things that people in his entourage are encouraging him to do.
Okay, so this is fascinating, and I don't know where we're going on this one, but did Trump's veto of the defense bill, does it play into all of that? Is there any factor where the president did something that hasn't been done in 60 years, and the fact that he was overridden, is that part of this in any way whatsoever? Because it certainly was one of those moments where the Congress exercised very unusual amounts of willingness, of independence and willingness to defy the president specifically on the defense bill.
Well, you know, for those of us who actually believe in the Constitution, you know, the Constitution in Article 1 basically says the Congress, you know, must provide for the common defense. A lot of the other things that they get to do, you know, they may do, but they must provide for the common defense. And that's a responsibility I think most members of Congress actually take pretty seriously. And there's been a National Defense Authorization bill, you know, every year that I can remember. If this veto had not been overridden, the Congress would have adjourned without actually passing, you know, a bill to authorize the defense of the United States. And I think that, you know, members of Congress obviously took that seriously. And I think it shows a little bit that, you know, his power is waning, as the day draws nigh where he will have to leave office, which I'm sure he didn't particularly like. But I didn't discuss that particular part of it. I did discuss it with, Vice President Cheney, but I didn't discuss it with the other secretaries. But I'm sure it was on their mind because the veto was inexplicable. I mean, the veto was pegged to repeal of Section 230 of the Communications Act, which, you know, regulates internet.
Nothing to do with it. Nothing.
But it has nothing to do with the defense of the United States. You know, I think that made people wonder what the real reason was that he, you know, vetoed the bill. I actually have my own pet theory about that, but which I think it had to do with the fact that the bill also, repeals anonymized shell companies, LLCs, which
interesting,
which he's profited by his whole real estate career. But whatever the reason was, I think they felt it was an utterly irresponsible act. While we have soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in the field, and while we were subject to one of the largest cyber attacks by Russia that anybody can remember, and the scope
so that might have contributed to the sense of his irresponsibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, at the same time, he's going through, and this is something that's not a recent phenomenon, but his fascination with defending and pardoning war criminals, ignoring the judgments of military courts and of the chain of command, and taking some actions that were pretty horrifying. I mean, I think that everything gets lost here, with everything that's going on. But his pardoning of the contractors who were involved in a massacre of civilians in Iraq, that can't have played well with the military.
No, I think not. I mean, he has reached in on multiple occasions and exercised what we call command influence, which you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to let the military justice system, take its course. But he's applied the same kind of loose standards to military justice that he has to the pardon power more broadly. And I think that has rubbed everybody in the military the wrong way, or not everybody, but most people the wrong way. And I suspect it also had an influence. Again, I didn't discuss that specifically with the secretaries when we were putting this letter together, but I suspect many of them had it on their minds.
Okay, I want to talk about what's going to be happening tomorrow. I think it's extraordinary that as many Republicans are going to vote not to count the electoral college votes. I had a podcast last week with Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger, and he said it could be 100 members. And I had to tell you, it was like a gut punch. And then, yeah, of course, within like 24, 48 hours, we found out it's not 100. It might be 140. It might be more than all of this. So over the next few days, we're going to get a definitive whip count of Republicans who are willing to undermine democracy on the basis of these conspiracy theories and the cynical grift. And of course, one of the most prominent of them is Senator Josh Hawley, who sort of jumped out ahead of the pack because I guess he figures that this is how he could punch his ticket for 2024 and raise some money off of it. But if you could just indulge me for a minute, Ambassador, rather extraordinary exchange last night with Bret Baier from, of all places, Fox News, who has Hawley. Maybe Hawley thought he was going to get an easy interview. But remember, this is a guy, he's got a Harvard law degree. He's supposed to be one of the intellectuals, Ted Cruz, constitutional scholars. And sadly, Bret Baier.
Sadly, Charlie, it's from one of my alma maters, Yale.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. I knew I was going to get that wrong. I should have had that. Yeah. Oh, yes. Covers Yale with my son's a graduate there too, and covers them with glory. But Bret Baier did a good job pushing back on him. This is about a minute and a half of this exchange, and you can kind of hear Josh Hawley squirming a little bit.
I want to pin you down on what you're trying to do. Are you trying to say that as of January 20th, that President Trump will be president?
Well, Brett, that depends on what happens on Wednesday. I mean, this is why we have the debate.
No, it doesn't. I mean, the states, by the Constitution, say they certify the election. They did certify it. By the Constitution, Congress doesn't have the right to overturn the certification, at least as most experts read it.
Well, Congress is directed under the 12th Amendment to count the electoral votes. There's a statute that dates back to the 1800s, 19th century, that says that there is a right to object, there's a right to be heard, and there's also a certification
right,
process.
Right, that's from 1876, Senator, and it's right. the Tilden-Hayes race in which there were three states that did not certify their electors. So Congress was left to come up with this system, this commission, that eventually got to a negotiated grand bargain. But now all of the states have certified their elections as of December 14th, so it doesn't, by constitutional ways, open a door to Congress to overturn that, does it?
Well, no, I'm talking about the statute, Brett. There's a statute that says, that governs what Congress does on January the 6th, and it says that we have a vote of certification and that we have the opportunity to debate the results, to certify the results. We count them and then we certify. And my point is, this is my only opportunity during this process to raise an objection and to be heard. I don't have standing to file lawsuits.
He can be heard any time. So Ambassador, it really is extraordinary because the Constitution doesn't say certify. The Constitution says count. And that's it. But it was interesting that Brett Baer pushed back on him and said, listen, the Constitution doesn't give the Congress the power to simply overturn an election. But that's about what at least a few dozen Republicans are going to do.
So let me if I might, Charlie, can I put take off my ambassador hat and put on my history PhD hat for a second? So first,
well, you're a double threat today.
First of all, think it's important for, you know, us Never Trumpers who like to dunk on Fox all the time for good reason, to remember that there are some people still like Brett Baer at Fox who are reasonably serious journalists. And Brett also is something of a serious amateur historian. He's written a couple of, pretty good books, including one very good book about Ronald Reagan and the Moscow summit that Reagan had with Gorbachev, which I happened to be at because I was serving at the embassy at the time. And so I know that Brett's book is pretty good on that. And so I take my hat off to him for not letting, Josh Hawley get away with, this kind of intellectual sleight of hand that he was trying to perform. And on the whole issue of, the objection and the Electoral Count Act of 1887, which was meant to clean up the mess of the contested 1876 election, I studied at Yale with C. Van Woodward, who was the great Southern historian who literally wrote the book on the 1876 mm-hmm. election called Reunion and Reaction. And the idea that, Hawley would be appealing to this statute and going back to that precedent, or that Ted Cruz, who is a Harvard law graduate, would use the Electoral Commission that was put together in 1876 as a precedent is so outrageous, both because it is not, an apt comparison to this year's election, but also because of what resulted from that particular episode. So first,
the end of Reconstruction.
The end of Reconstruction, the abandonment of freed slaves to, essentially 100 years of terrorism at the hands of the Ku Klux Klan. The three states that were at issue, Florida, South Carolina, and Louisiana, had, and particularly South Carolina, enormous amounts of what was called white capping. It was the Klan and others in hoods terrorizing voters. You had rival slates of electors, some certified by legislatures, some by governors. So there was an actual issue to adjudicate. None of that obtains today after more than 60 court cases. It's complete nonsense. It's the equivalent of the faux intellectualism that goes with their faux populism. There's just not enough supply of pork rinds in the world for Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz to be able to consume to turn them into, real populists.
Yeah, that's as bogus as, I agree with you. So one of the extraordinary things about tomorrow, I think, and we all need to step back and just get some perspective. This should be the easiest vote of most of their congressional careers. Just simply to uphold the Constitution. It's a ministerial function. And instead, what they're going to do is they're going to vote to, try to disrupt this election. And look, there's no real debate here because there are no facts here. I mean, Rob Portman, I mentioned other Republicans who've come out against this, said, you know, after 2 months of recounts and legal challenges, not a single state recount changed the result. And of the dozens of lawsuits filed, not one found evidence of fraud or irregularities widespread enough to change the result of the election. Even Attorney General Bill Barr said there wasn't enough irregularities to change the election. So, I mean, this really kind of needs to be emphasized here. You know, to vote against certifying these votes, these Republicans are going to have to give all of these crazy conspiracy theories, these lies, the misinformation, the rumors, more credence than the decisions by all the state and local officials, the canvassing boards, the secretaries of state, the governors, the legislatures, and courts at every level, both state and federal. They're going to have to basically say, yeah, the kinds of things that Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and Donald Trump are saying have more weight than all of these court decisions, all of the findings of the Department of Justice. That's an amazing thing that they're doing to themselves.
You left out Lynn Wood in your list of crazy people whose ideas.
Oh, he's just completely insane.
So, I mean, yeah. I mean, and therein lies, I think, the lasting damage. Because they will be, giving legitimacy to this stuff, which all of them know is, I mean, maybe Marjorie Greene, you know, Taylor Greene doesn't know it, but everybody else knows it, that this is nonsense. And they're going to give it, you know, longer life. It's going to be very damaging, you know, for the Biden administration to try and, you know, take office amidst this, you know, miasma of lies that is being created. It's essentially sedition, really. It's the sedition caucus.
It is. And I have to admit that I admire tremendously the election officials in Georgia who've stood up to the president, and Gabe Sterling, who had that remarkable press conference yesterday where, you know, he went through point by point by point. So I admired him, but I also felt sorry for him because he seems to think that facts still matter. And what's very clear is that there's kind of this screaming void out there. Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue and Donald Trump, they're just not listening. They are immune to information. They've created this wall. So he's there point by point going through lie after lie after lie with his big chart. Here's the claims. Here are the facts. And it doesn't seem to register with these folks. And so, you know, that's on the ballot today. And you know, if as I would expect, the Republicans win in Georgia, because they tend to win in Georgia during these runoffs, you know, it will be seen, unfortunately, as a ratification of this sort of post-fact, post-truth culture there. And so what are we left with when you have the truth tellers like Brad Raffensperger and Gabriel Sterling, and they're treated like pariahs by much of our political culture on the right?
Well, and, you know, to have people basically say, oh, the outrage, you know, on Sunday was not the president of the United States calling up a state election official who's trying to do his job, who happens to be a Republican, and to try and browbeat him into manufacturing votes to allow the president to claim that he, you know, won Georgia erroneously, that putting that tape out and letting people hear what was on the tape was the real sin here, as opposed to what the president did. It is so perverse.
It is.
And it's, you know, you could make an argument, I suppose, that Raffensperger violated the president's confidence if he had just gone out and put the tape out. He only did it after Trump tweeted out a totally false account of their phone call.
Yeah. And so you're right. This faux indignation to actually find out the truth of all of this. I'm trying to think of our friend David French had a good tweet. He said, so apparently the MAGA line is that it's not wrong for Trump to lie about Raffensperger and to press him to break the law. That's not what's wrong. Instead, it's somehow wrong to expose Trump. So it's okay for Trump to fight with lies, but it's not okay to fight back with truth. This is exactly right. Absolutely. This is their culture. Ambassador Eric Edelman, thank you so much for joining us and for your contributions, getting that remarkable letter together, which I think we're going to look back and see that as one of the turning points in this rather dangerous time.
I hope so.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.